Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A Pistorius witness say the athlete was very upset after the shooting. And Niger extradites a son of Gaddafi to Libya. I'm Francis Alonso reporting from Washington. The neighbor of Oscar Pistorius says he found the Olympic athlete kneeling and praying over his dying girlfriend after he shot her in his Pretoria home. Testifying on the fourth day of Pistorius's trial, radiologist Johan Stepp said he entered the athlete's home minutes after hearing screams and shots and saw Pistorius weeping by Riva Stenkamp's body.
When I saw that, I couldn't do anything for her. Because I thought when I arrived there, maybe if you can just hold down a wound or stop bleeding, that could help. But she was way too seriously injured for that. And I noticed that Oscar was going upstairs and asked Mr. Stander if he knew where the gun was. Because it was obvious that Oscar was emotionally very, very upset. And I didn't know the situation in the house, so I thought maybe he was going to hurt himself.
Pistorius has admitted to shooting Stenkamp, but says he mistakenly believed he was firing at an intruder. Prosecutors say Pistorius killed Stenkamp after an argument. The Libyan government says Niger has extradited Saadi Gaddafi, the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Prime Minister Ali Zeidan's office said in a statement that Gaddafi arrived today and is now in jail in the capital of Tripoli. The younger Gaddafi fled to Niger, which is just south of Libya, following the NATO-backed uprising that ousted and killed his father in 2011. Government photos showed Saadi with a shaved head and a blue prison outfit. Libya insists he will be treated in accordance with international law. Lawmakers in Crimea have voted in favor of the Ukrainian region becoming part of Russia. Today's vote by the Crimean parliament came as European Union leaders gathered for an emergency summit in Brussels to discuss how to pressure Russia to back down from its military incursion into Crimea. The government of Crimea said it's scheduling a referendum on whether to join Russia for March 16th. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who is in Brussels for the EU meeting, called the Crimean Parliament's vote to join Russia an illegal decision and said his government is urging Moscow not to support those who advocate separatism.
We stick to the political option, and it depends on Russia whether Russia is ready to fix this conflict, whether Russia is too ready to have the real debate over the ways how to stabilize the situation, or Russia is as always reluctant and will try to increase the tension as they did a few hours ago. They resumed the blockade of Ukrainian naval forces, so they still are provoking the clashes and the tension. And we urge the Russian president and the Russian government immediately to pull back its forces and to stick to international agreements that were signed between Ukraine and Russia.
You can read more details on this story at voanews.com. A NATO airstrike killed 5 Afghan soldiers and wounded at least 8 others early today in the eastern province of Logar. A spokeswoman for the international forces in Afghanistan said the troops were accidentally killed during a military operation. She said an investigation is ongoing to determine the cause of the incident and sent condolences to the families of those killed. Chinese state media are defending the double-digit increase in defense spending announced this week by Beijing, saying concern over China's growing military strength are unnecessary. The premier there announced on Wednesday that China will spend almost $132 billion on its army in 2014. North Korea has rejected South Korea's proposal for talks on resuming reunions between families separated by the 1950s Korean War. Seoul's unification ministry says the North delivered the message today that a proper atmosphere had not been created to resume the talks. A Malaysian court has begun hearing a government appeal against the sodomy acquittal of opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. A high court in 2012 found Anwar not guilty of having sex with the man who was in his aide. This is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The World Health Organization says women's rights must be respected and protected when they seek contraception services. The WHO has issued new guidelines for policymakers and healthcare providers in conjunction with International Women's Day on March 8th.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the UN Security Council extends a partial arms embargo on Somalia through October. The Libyan government says Niger has extradited Saadi Gaddafi, the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, and an international humanitarian organization partners with an Ethiopian hospital to improve cardiac care for children. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the United Nations Security Council has extended a partial arms embargo on Somalia through October because of reports that militants are getting weapons intended for government forces. All 15 council members agreed yesterday that the requirements for ending the 22-year embargo have not been met. They also condemn the misuse of such weapons as a serious threat to peace and security. The embargo was partially lifted a year ago to get more weapons to Somali forces fighting al-Shabaab militants. Al-Shabaab wants to turn Somalia into a conservative Muslim state. Somali and African Union forces have pushed the group from the capital of Mogadishu, but it still controls other parts of the country and remains a major threat. In other news on Somalia, Ethiopian and Somali troops today defeated al-Shabaab insurgents in the small town of Rabdura in southern Somalia near the Ethiopian border. The town was believed to be a major base for al-Shabaab attacks across the Bakool region. The VOA service, Somali service reports that an al-Shabaab spokesman has appealed to local clansmen to repel the Ethiopian forces. This is the first AMISOM victory in more than 6 months of fighting. Observers believe it's the start of the government's long-promised major offensive against the Islamist militant force. Coming up on 8 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Libyan government says Niger has extradited Saadi Gaddafi, the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Prime Minister Ali Zaidan's office said in a statement, Saadi Gaddafi arrived today and is now in jail in the capital of Tripoli. The younger Gaddafi fled to Niger, which is just south of Libya, following the NATO-backed uprising that ousted and killed his father in 2011. Government photos showed Saadi with a shaved head in a blue prison outfit. Libya insists he will be treated in accordance with international law. Saadi, one of Gaddafi's eight children, is wanted by Libya for alleged corruption and armed intimidation as head of the Libyan Football Federation. His brother Saif al-Islam is wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged crimes against humanity. He is being held by Libyan militia groups. An appeals court in Cairo today suspended the third trial of Egypt's ex-president Mohamed Morsi. Defense lawyers claim two of three judges on the panel are biased against Mr. Morsi, who was ousted from office and arrested on July 3rd of last year. He faces charges of inciting mobs that led to the deaths of protesters in December 2012. Mr. Morsi and others who served in his administration or in the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood also face charges of conspiring with foreign powers, escaping from jail, and attacking police stations during protests against his predecessor, Hosni Mubarak. Also in Egypt, the Armed Forces Chief Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has said he cannot ignore calls by Egyptians for him to run for president. His statement, quoted by the state news agency MENA, is seen as the clearest indication yet that he will stand in the election scheduled to take place by mid-April. El-Sisi has been widely expected to resign from his army post and declare a presidential bid since the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces gave its public support at the end of January. Egyptian-born Mohammed El-Shenawi is VOA's senior Mideast correspondent. My colleague Ashnafi Abeje asked El-Shenawi if he agrees with the prevailing view that El-Sisi will soon announce his presidential candidacy.
Actually, he said that he's waiting for the election law to be issued, and after that he will take the formal steps to run for presidency. So it's not a secret now that he is intending to bring the army again to politics by running himself, and with the pouring love that was created based on hating the Muslim Brotherhood 1 year in power, made it possible for him to come as the savior of Egypt.
Well, you may have touched on it. We hear so much about the popularity Sisi is enjoying at the moment, both within the army and among the Egyptian population at large. Is that due primarily to, as you put it, the hatred for the previous administration, or is there something unique El-Sisi has to offer the Egyptian population?
Actually, he's using rhetoric promises like, I will make Egypt the size of the whole world, or I never saw anybody kind enough to Egypt and I will be the one. And apparently that rings a bell in the psyche of the Egyptian people, who are used to rely on a hero or a pharaoh. Pharaoh in the past, hero in the recent history during President Nasser. They put their hopes in one person, and that led to disastrous results in Egypt's stance in the area. And Marshal Sisi realized soon that with an Egyptian debt amounting to around 1.7 trillion Egyptian pounds, or about $550 billion, sentimental rhetoric will not wash that away. So as some analysts in Egypt advised him, the cup of love would soon evaporate, so be prepared.
No doubt, of course, whether it's Field Marshal El-Sisi or whoever else wins the presidency, monumental task ahead, the new leader of Egypt. But if El-Sisi actually runs and in fact wins the presidency, as most people expect, does this mean in effect a reversal of the Egyptian revolution?
Actually, yes. This is being expressed by all liberals and the youth of the revolution, but was attacked heavily by the Mubarak's crony media that's misleading the public and made no room for dissent, attacking any different point of view. And the people of Egypt didn't go to the streets in 2011 to replace an old general with a new one. And the real problem is General Sisi didn't have a platform that he's running on. He's just running on popularity. And that's a dangerous game in Egyptian environment full of economic and social problems.
I know you follow Egyptian politics very closely. How would you describe Field Marshal El-Sisi, both as an individual and as a leader?
As an individual, he doesn't strike intellectuals as an intellectual guy. He is using the language that is used in small unit of the army, which is basic rhetoric, and using national themes to mobilize people. As a person, I don't have any doubt that he is nationalistic, but Egypt needs more than that.
VOA senior Mideast correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawi, he spoke with my colleague Ashnafi Abeje. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The president of Tunisia today lifted a three-year state of emergency. The emergency powers were enacted when autocrat Zine El Abidine Ben Ali was thrown out of office. Today's announcement suggests the decline of fighting between hardline Islamists of Ansar al-Sharia and security forces. The lifting of the state of emergency may also encourage tourism, which had declined by 1 million from the pre-revolt figure of 7 million. The World Health Organization says human rights must be respected and protected when women seek contraception services. The WHO has issued new guidelines for policymakers and healthcare providers in conjunction with International Women's Day on March 8th. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The WHO estimates over 220 million women are not able to meet their needs for modern contraception. It says many are among the most vulnerable, including the poor, those living with HIV, and women displaced by conflict or other causes. Dr. Marlene Temmerman is an obstetrician and director of the WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research.
It's the first time that there is a guidance from WHO where human rights is actually in the title, and not only in the title, but also in the content of the guidelines. We have guidelines for contraceptive use from the medical perspective, looking at what is safe, what are the medical eligibility criteria, what is contraindications, and so on. But now we have worked towards ensuring human rights in the contraceptive guidelines.
The WHO has been developing the guidelines for the past year.
We want to make sure that the human rights principles, such as acceptability, accessibility, affordability, choice, informed consent, are high in the guidelines.
The guidelines recommend providing sexual and reproductive health services to women and girls, including family planning information and contraceptive methods. Dr. Timmerman says access to contraception has risen on the political agenda in recent years.
If you look at the Millennium Development Goals, number 5 is to reduce maternal mortality. And that, of course, is linked to better care, better antenatal care, better delivery care, but also to the right of a woman to decide when she will get pregnant, how many children she wants.
She says millions of women must seek permission of their husbands to use contraception, while adolescent girls need permission from their parents or guardians. Many adolescent boys also lack access to modern contraception. Timmerman says women and girls often have no power in deciding whether to become pregnant.
Many women are coerced in their decision to be pregnant or not to be pregnant by their family, their father, the mother, the husband, the mother-in-law, the society, the community, by cultural and religious obstacles, but sometimes also by the governments who are forcing tubalization, forcing sterilization onto some women and not giving access to others.
She says teenage girls who become pregnant may face severe risks. The WHO estimates 16 million girls between 15 and 19 give birth each year. Nearly all the births are in low and middle income countries.
We see a lot of pregnancy complications in adolescents that are really leading to a lot of mortality and morbidity, so a huge health burden.
The WHO says some of the problems associated with negative outcomes for adolescent pregnancies include hemorrhaging, obstetric fistula, HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, and mental disorders such as depression. Dr. Timmerman says countries where women and girls have access to modern contraception often fare better overall than countries that do not.
I think what we have to do is to look at the statistics. Those countries who are providing sexuality education and information to the population and to the youth in the schools, those countries who are providing adolescents and women-friendly services have the lowest figures of unwanted pregnancies, maternal mortality, and so on. So health-wise, they do much better.
Timmerman says besides the health benefits of investing in reproductive services, countries benefit economically by having a more productive workforce. The new WHO guidelines say sexual and reproductive health services should help ensure fully informed decision-making and respect dignity, autonomy, privacy and confidentiality, and be sensitive to individual needs. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, up on 20 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. An Israeli-based program says it's increasing its efforts to help children in Ethiopia with congenital and rheumatic heart disease. The project, called Save a Child's Heart, works with children of all ages around the world. In Ethiopia, it will be working with the Black Lion Hospital in Addis Ababa in a move to treat an additional 50 to 75 children a year. One of the group's board members, Jeff Hoffman, explained to me how their program reaches children whose families cannot afford the surgery needed to save their lives.
So we screen them in Ethiopia, children that need heart surgery, and send them over to Israel, where they stay in a children's home, sometimes with their mothers, depending on their age, and they receive heart surgery, and they have a few months to recover, and then they're returned home to the care of the physicians that referred them. Right now, we have kids from many different countries in Israel receiving treatment. We serve about 250 to 300 children a year. Usually half of those children are Palestinian children, and then the other half are from Africa and other countries. Right now we have children from Palestine, Ethiopia, Ghana, Romania, Iraq, Tanzania, and several other countries. They receive surgery, and then they go back home.
And also, does your organization look to working with hospitals to make sure that they are staffed appropriately for children with heart ailments?
We currently have a couple of doctors from Ethiopia in training. We are training several Palestinian doctors in pediatric cardiac care so that they can build a cardiac unit in Ramallah. So our goal is eventually to help build capacity in different countries so that they can do the surgeries within their own country. But it still takes a long time to train these physicians. We just completed training of a Tanzanian pediatric surgeon. He was in training for 5 years in Israel. Just went back to Tanzania a few months ago, and he is now the first pediatric cardiac surgeon in the country, 50 million people, and is developing a cardiac care unit in Mwanza, Tanzania.
What types of cases do you all treat?
They treat heart disease, both genetic and, you know, those that have developed over time. Well, many cases are due to rheumatic heart disease from untreated rheumatic fever. In many countries, there's not adequate treatment for that. Some are just genetic abnormalities, holes in their hearts, and other problems. So it's the full range of cardiac problems that children have. Sometimes, if they're very extensive, they may not be able to travel to Israel for that surgery. But whatever cases we think we can handle, we'll bring over and repair their hearts.
What types of challenges do doctors face in treating children with heart diseases and heart ailments in countries such as Ethiopia?
First of all, the problem is prevention. So you have many children who just go untreated, as I mentioned, with rheumatic fever, and simple course of antibiotic could have prevented the heart problem in many cases. But children go undiagnosed, or they don't have the, especially in rural areas, that don't have very good medical care. So there's a big problem of heart disease that develops, unfortunately, that could have been treated. And one of our goals is to see improved prevention in these countries where there's early diagnosis and treatment with antibiotics of strep throat and rheumatic fever that can lead to heart disease in a small number of cases. Then you need to have facilities to treat heart disease, and you need a full surgical team with all of the equipment that's necessary, and you need to have expertise not only in heart surgery, but cardiac care, intensive care, anesthesia. So there are several different components to treating heart disease, and many developing countries are in the early stages of developing that full range of capability. There's been a lot of progress in Ethiopia, and they do have a cardiac care unit that they're developing, and I'm optimistic that they will be able to do full range of care within the next couple of years.
Can you give us a cost breakdown, just on average? I know that it varies depending on what the condition of the child, but just on average, a cost breakdown of heart surgery for a child.
The average cost per child is $10,000. We try to raise $10,000 per surgery. We do a number of fundraisers and raise money from foundations and so forth. We'll be having a fundraising activity at the Ethiopian Embassy this Saturday night, March 8th. It's an attempt to raise money to be able to conduct more surgeries for children.
That was Jeff Hoffman, board member for Save a Child's Heart. He spoke with me from Rockville, Maryland. Well, pressure is mounting on British forensic auditors to release the names of suspects in what is known as Malawi's Cashgate scandal. Malawians have trashed the report of the audit team, which omitted names of individuals and companies said to be involved in the massive corruption scandal. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
The government of Malawi hired a British company, Baker Tilly International, to audit its departments between April and September 2013. The company's report found the government lost about $30 million during that period through fraud, theft, and unethical actions. The report says nearly half of the money went to 16 private companies for services they did not provide. It says this was done by taking advantage of a loophole in the government's financial management system. That hole has now been sealed. However, auditors say they could not release the names of people and companies allegedly involved in the scandal to avoid jeopardizing the ongoing investigations. Members of the Parliament Public Accounts Committee, or PAC, say the absence of suspects' names renders the report a useless document and infringes upon the rights of taxpayers to know who embezzled the money. Beatrice Mwangonde is the chairperson of PAC.
We want to believe that this report belongs, you know, to the people of Malawi, so we should have a say on how we use this report. We are looking forward to meeting, you know, these auditors so that they tell us why they are withholding, you know, this information.
Finance Minister Maxwell Nkwezalamba said the government had been strongly advised not to release the names of the suspects for ethical reasons. British High Commissioner to Malawi, Michael Nevin, whose country funded the audit, told a local radio station that releasing the names at this time would be counterproductive.
We all want to know the full extent of the scandal, and we want to bring to account all those who were involved. So, in our view, if you release the names, you endanger that goal. So that the desire by the public to have the names released now may be counterproductive to that. We also might jeopardize the judicial process.
Malawi President Joyce Banda told reporters Tuesday that she also wants to learn the names, but understands why investigators are keeping that information private.
We are eager to know the names.
She says, in fact, all people in the country are eager to know the names, but she was told that if the names are released now, the suspects would fly and some would decide to tamper with evidence. She says another issue is that ethically, auditors are not allowed to carelessly release the names of the suspects to avoid being sued once their findings prove to the contrary. The president said she has asked the British auditors to come back to Malawi and defend their position before PAC members. The audit team is expected to meet with PAC in the capital, Lilongwe, on March 10. Malawi police uncovered the scandal in September last year, resulting in the arrest of over 60 people, including civil servants, business people, and politicians. An investigation found that as much as $250 million could not be accounted for. In response, donor countries heard up about $150 million in budget aid, putting a strain on the country's economy. Donors are expected to meet later this month on whether to resume funding. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Security Council extends a partial arms embargo on Somalia through October. The Libyan government says Niger has extradited Saadi Gaddafi, the son of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. And the WHO says human rights must be respected and protected when women seek contraception services. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I hear you're kicking off today with African football.
Kim, let's kick off with African football. Africa's five World Cup-bound teams were all in action Wednesday in friendly international matches as they get ready for Brazil 2014. Of the five, only the Desert Foxes of Algeria came away with a victory. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma reports the Algerians received a boost from a Brazilian football great.
Hosts Algeria beat Slovenia 2-0 in a friendly match played in Blida. World football legend Edson Arantes do Nascimento, who is popularly known as Pele, watched the match, then told the Algerian media that Algeria has the potential to pull a surprise at the World Cup in Brazil in June, the way they did when they beat Germany 2-1 at the 1982 World Cup opener in Italy.
The Desert Foxes of Algeria will face Belgium June 17th in their 2014 World Cup opener in Belo Horizonte, Brazil. The Algerians are making their fourth World Cup appearance. In their three previous appearances, they did not advance past the first round. Getting back to Brazilian football great Pelé, if you go to the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page, at facebook.com/VOA Sunny, you'll see a photo of Pelé posing with a couple of Algerian players before their match against Slovenia. In the photo, Pelé looks a bit somber, and there are dark clouds behind him in the Blida skyline. In the comments section, I couldn't resist writing, "Cheer up, Pelé, while there are dark clouds behind you. Let's try and stay on the sunny side."
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
More friendly results from Wednesday on the Voice of America involving World Cup-bound African teams. African champion Nigeria and Mexico played to a scoreless draw in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia. Host Montenegro defeated Ghana 1-0. Ivory Coast and host Belgium played to a 2-2 draw. The Belgians pulled in front 2-0 before the Elephants of Ivory Coast equalized on second-half goals from Didier Drogba and Max-Alain Gradel. And finally, host Portugal whacked Cameroon 5-1. Cristiano Ronaldo, Portugal's reigning FIFA World Player of the Year, had 2 goals in the match. Another lopsided result from Soccer City in Johannesburg. Brazil spanked host South Africa 5-0. Barcelona star Neymar, who has been described as the poster boy of the 2014 World Cup, had 3 goals for the Brazilians, who will be bidding for their record 6th World Cup title on home soil this year.
I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Nnamdi, the man widely regarded as the best pound for pound or kilo for kilo fighter in the world.
Like I always say, for every fight, everybody had a game plan. As of right now, there's not a blueprint on how to beat Floyd Mayweather. No one has found the way to break the Mayweather code.
Floyd Mayweather has lined up his next fight for May 3rd against Marcos Maidana from Argentina. How's this fight shaping up, Nnamdi?
It's a good fight because the Maidana we know, he will stand and fight. He's a puncher. He's a dangerous puncher. He's a knockout artist, which means even though if he's going in the late round, he can come back and just take you out. And when he's knocked down and he comes up, he's like a black mamba or a python, you know, he can still take you out. So he's a dangerous puncher. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that this cat can knock out a cow. In 35 fights, he has 31 knockouts, Sonny.
Nnamdi,
so he's a big puncher.
Maidana coming off the biggest victory of his career over Adrian Broner. Broner was a heavy favorite. Do you think Mayweather watched that fight and will learn from it, Nnamdi?
Oh, yeah. I mean, remember, Broner was undefeated when he went against Maidana, and Maidana had him on the floor. That was the first time ever, you know. So what will Mayweather learn from Maidana Broner? Well, we will see on come in May, but we know one thing. He will not have to look for Maidana, unlike another fighter that he will have to chase around the ring. Mind you, Mayweather is not a young guy anymore, so he needs a guy that will come sit right in his face, go toe-to-toe, and then pound for pound, see who's the best.
Amir Khan was mentioned as a possible opponent for Mayweather. What happened to Khan, Nnamdi?
Well, it's quite a case of bad management. Last time Amir Khan fought was April 2013, almost a year. He's been sitting around. He was offered a fight against Devon Alexander for the IBF welterweight title in December. He turned that down, waiting for the Money Mayweather sweepstakes, you know. He missed out on that right now because fight fans believe Amir Khan is not really a welterweight. He has a glass chin, so nobody wants to pay $70 to see Mayweather put on a boxing lesson and have to chase this guy all around the ring, and it's make for a bad fight. So it just was not a fight the fight fans want to see.
What about the Hispanic fight crowd, Nnamdi? Are they interested in watching Maidana take on Mayweather?
Son, Hispanic fight fans are funny people. If it's not a Mexican, you know. they will come, but they're not going to come out like a Canelo turnout, you know. I mean, this guy is from Argentina. He's the Argentine brawler, you know. He's not a Mexican. If he's a Mexican, yeah, they'll show up in big numbers. But still, you know, he speaks Spanish. He can do a lot for Spanish television, do a lot for foreign TV, and then speak the boxing language that will make people come out. He's a puncher. He's a fighter. People want to see the Mexican fans. They love that, but he's not a Mexican. He's from Argentina, so that's the big deal there.
Nnamdi, before Mayweather, Maidana.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
The Pac-Man, Manny Pacquiao, will have a rematch against Timothy Bradley on April 12th. Talk about that fight, Nnamdi.
Well, it's a rematch from the last time. We believe Manny Pacquiao beat Bradley. But what has happened after the first Bradley-Manny Pacquiao fight? Bradley went against Ruslan from Russia, and that was a great fight, and came back with a win with Juan Manuel Marquez. What has happened between the last time Bradley and Pacquiao fought? Pacquiao got blown out. Cold, you know. So the rematch is not going to be the same. Everybody will think it's going to be an easy fight for Manny Pacquiao because the first one was easy. But Manny's coming into this fight after being banged by Juan Manuel Marquez, though he has a victory against Brandon Rios. But Brandon Rios in the real game is not a welterweight. He's a lightweight. So it's going to be an interesting fight come April 12th, MGM Grand Casino with Bradley and Manny Pacquiao.
If Pacquiao can win, Namdi, and maybe, what do you think? Do you think Mayweather would want to end his career by taking on Manny Pacquiao?
Well, Manny Pacquiao's contract with the promoter, Bob Arum, will expire at the end of the year. The only way the fight with Mayweather can be made is when Manny Pacquiao will walk away from Bob Arum and then will sit down with Mayweather and they can then break bread and make the fight. Because we're talking about big money for this fight. But he has to beat Timothy Bradley. He may come out short on this rematch with Timothy Bradley. If Timothy Bradley beats him the second time, you can forget about Manny Pacquiao against Floyd Mayweather.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, who's always ready to fire a few verbal jabs on our Voice of America airwaves. And we'll hear more knockout commentary from Namdi on Friday's Sunny Side of Sports. Let's check the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page now for a comment or two. Again, the address for our VOA listeners is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Elijah Oyewale, writing from Nigeria's commercial capital of Lagos, comments on the performances of the five African World Cup-bound teams in Wednesday's friendlies. Elijah says, not the very best of results for our African representatives, but I'm optimistic Africa will have a good tournament. I like your optimism, Elijah. Another one of our VOA listeners in Nigeria, Chinedu Friday in Benin City, comments on Brazil's big 5-0 victory over host South Africa at Soccer City in Johannesburg. Chinedu says playing a friendly match with South Africa will not strengthen your team because, in Chinedu's words, the South African team doesn't know what it's doing at the moment. Daniel Masha, also writing from Nigeria, has kinder words for the South Africans. Daniel says kudos must still go to the South African coach, Gordon Igesund. He's never scared of playing big teams, despite South Africa's poor run in international football. A real hiding there at Soccer City Stadium. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, international officials say Kenya has achieved one of the best investment climates in East Africa for the development of new energy resources. And the World Bank approves a $5.5 million credit to the government of Lesotho to improve the country's public financial management system. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Josephine Atanga of Cameroon with Ring Those Bells.
Jesus, we remember this, your birthday. Everybody likes
Okay, that was Josephine Atenga. Well, Kenya has achieved one of the best investment climates in East Africa for the development of new energy resources. That's what officials from the U.S. International Development Agency said recently. They visited a new power-generating plant in Baringo County, where the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative is powering up. Ruben Kayama has the story.
President Barack Obama launched the Power Africa initiative last June to boost electrical power generation in Kenya, Ethiopia, Ghana, Liberia, Nigeria, and Tanzania. With support from the World Bank and the African Development Bank, the goal is to add more than 10,000 megawatts of clean, efficient electricity generation capacity and provide 20 million new businesses and households in sub-Saharan Africa with some form of access to electrical power. In Kenya, USAID has fostered a public-private partnership between the Cunnings Cogeneration Kenya Limited, a local firm, and the government of Kenya to develop 12-megawatt biomass-fueled on-grid electricity generation. Officials from the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, have been visiting Kenya this week to evaluate the progress of President Obama's initiatives toward fostering public-private partnerships. These initiatives underpin the U.S. and Kenya's shared development goals. Three USAID officials toward the East African nation and visited a biomass energy plant in Marigat, Baringo County, about 220 kilometers northwest of Nairobi. The USAID Assistant Administrator for Africa, Earl Gast, spoke about the plant, which is run by Cummins Power. Gast said the people in the community used to cut down the trees to make charcoal, but now sell the wood to the plant, which converts it into steam to generate electricity.
We estimate that through this process that they will earn at least four times what they're earning now for the same amount of wood that they're cutting down. So it's very lucrative to them. And actually, it's very lucrative to the villages and to the people of Kenya throughout, because that power that's being produced then goes on to the grid and benefits the local community as well as the national community.
Gast said President Obama wants to focus on smaller communities where the U.S. and Kenyan government and private business can lift people out of poverty. He said the Baringo project can be repeated in other parts of Kenya and Africa.
Got these small biomass projects that can help immediately supply electricity to communities and then also provide economic opportunities to them by selling the fuel. And as you know, power isn't reliable here, but you've seen the transformational benefits of power. It means that people have access to health care because equipment can run. It means that people have access to lighting, and that means that children can learn and read at night. So, and of course, power provides even more opportunity for economic growth. Businesses can operate, and they can produce their products at a very reasonable and competitive price.
Gast also described some of the Power Africa projects in Kenya's future: wind parks in Kinangop and Lake Turkana. He estimated they could generate 450 megawatts of power. According to Gast, Kenya is better than the five other targeted countries in terms of identifying private partners with good credit. He said finding private partners with good credit is essential.
That is probably one of the most the biggest deterrents across Africa. And so what we're trying to do is explore with other development agencies like the African Development Bank ways of shoring up the creditworthiness of the off-takers to include providing partial risk guarantees and other mechanisms.
He said Kenya has more experience with the public-private partnerships with the energy projects going on in the country, and that Nairobi has become an African hub of energy activity. The world's largest manufacturer, General Electric, a company he said is worth $110 billion, as Africa headquarters in Nairobi. Power Africa headquarters are also located in Nairobi.
So a lot of investors are waiting to see, you know, how it plays out. We have a saying in the U.S., which I think is which definitely applies to Africa and definitely applies to power sector generation, and that is success breeds success. So, you know, once you have one investor coming in, providing a very valuable power to the country, but being able to make a reasonable profit and employing local people, you'll see other investors coming in as well. And we're seeing that in the case of Kenya. So we feel that, this is a great place to be.
Public-private partnerships are complex business agreements that demand transparency and constant monitoring. Gast says if that happens, all of the partners and the public they serve can learn who earns the profits from the investment and who among the Kenyan public benefits from the services. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Bank has approved a $5.5 million credit to the government of Lesotho to improve the country's public financial management system. From Lesotho, Senior Operations Officer Macmillan Aniyawu tells Odette Fraser three ways they can disperse the funds.
According to the implementation arrangement for the project, there will be three options for disbursing funds. One of the options would be we require the government of Lesotho to create a designated account. And in this designated account, we would periodically replenish the account to cover the local operating costs or any other costs that the project team may incur. The other option we have, in cases where the government of Lesotho incurs expenses under this project, we would have provision for reimbursement if they incur the expenses with their own funds. The other option for disbursement we have, depending on the circumstances, would also be direct payment to contractors or suppliers under the project.
According to a World Bank press release, the credit is to support Lesotho's efforts for improving the country's public financial management system, and the primary focus of the project will be the re-engineering of its integrated financial management information system. Why hasn't the financial management information system worked in the past?
One of the key lessons we learned, why this didn't really work. Because initially it was dealt with as purely technical issue by providing the integrated financial management system and all the necessary hard and software that were required. But we then realized that the issue of capacity and ability of the human resources to implement and operate the systems were not there. We didn't have enough qualified financial accountants in the public service. And so what we have done since that last intervention was to help develop local capacity for qualified accountants. We partnered with the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountants to help build capacity locally here to undertake financial management and accounting training. And I think we have wanted to fill that gap so far. Currently, we thought that this is an opportunity for us to try to fix some of the technical and adaptive issues that the system has faced so far. So now that we have the required human resources to operate the system, we think it is time to fix some of the technical issues in the integrated financial management system.
Will the bank provide any oversight to assist Lesotho with this project?
Definitely. In this particular operation, we would have three levels of oversight here. The first level of oversight would be on the technical side. We would continue, as the project continues implementation, to provide technical assistance and implementation support. And this would require technical teams to be on ground to look at the work the project implementation team is doing. The second level of oversight would be on the fiduciary side. We would continue to provide financial management and procurement reviews to all the procurement packages that have to go out in this project to make sure that they conform with the agreed financial management and procurement guidelines. And the other level of oversight we have is through financial audit. The condition in the project requires that the government of Lesotho get an independent auditor who would give us an opinion on the state of financial affairs in the project at least 6 months after the end of each fiscal year.
Macmillan Aniyawu is the World Bank's Senior Operations Officer in Lesotho. He was speaking with Odette Fraser in Maseru, Lesotho. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday, And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kwasi Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fighting and deadly attacks against innocent civilians continue in South Sudan, despite an agreement signed on January 23rd to cease hostilities. Elements of both sides in the conflict have ignored the agreement, inflicting much pain and suffering. The resumption of hostilities have cast a pall over peace talks being held in Ethiopia to seek a political settlement to the crisis, but it is hoped they will resume after negotiators confer with their respective leaders. The United States is following the situation closely and is deeply concerned by reports of serious human rights abuses and violations committed by both parties. A true cessation of hostilities is our government's most pressing priority, and we are providing $6 million to the Intergovernmental Authority on Development to help achieve it. The group, known as IGAD, is moderating the peace talks and now setting up a verification mechanism to monitor and identify violators. This will be key to making the ceasefire work, and in turn, draw attention back to the larger issue at hand, achieving an inclusive and lasting political settlement. The IGAD mediators have proposed a meaningful political dialogue between the two parties, but one that also draws in a broad representation of stakeholders. The roots of this crisis run deep, reaching well back before fighting erupted in mid-December. Many historical grievances remained after creation of the new nation in 2011. On top of that, the government progressively reduced the ability for political activists, media, and civil society to voice their concerns. When negotiations resume, the political settlement must be more than a quick fix. Accommodating the two parties and their immediate needs will not bring a sustainable peace. A spectrum of South Sudanese stakeholders must be brought into the process and allowed to take part in national affairs. Reconciliation must also follow, as well as accountability for the serious human rights abuses that have occurred. Finally, all parties must allow immediate and unconditional access for aid groups to assist the hundreds of thousands of displaced civilians who are the real victims of the violence, a humanitarian crisis that will only intensify in the coming months with the return of the rainy season.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.